Congress is in the first round of writing an annual defense authorization bill. Lawmakers are determined to protect their weapon systems, even when the Pentagon says it can't afford them. And while parochialism is hardly new on Capitol Hill, DOD thinks it spells big trouble when there's no new money coming its way. Federal News Radio's Jared Serbu joins us to share a couple examples taken from his reporter's notebook, which you can find on federalnewsradio.com. Hi, Jared.
Hey, good morning.
So, Jared, first of all, let's catch up on this defense authorization bill. Congress seems to like things more like the status quo than the Pentagon does.
Yeah, status quo, I think, is the perfect word, Emily. And I picked out the example of the Air Force and its personnel reductions for the notebook this week. Not necessarily because it's the biggest issue in the DOD budget, but just because I think it's kind of illustrative of what's going on during this early part of the defense bill markup, you know, in this environment where Congress has told DOD and the rest of government, frankly, that it's got to live under these arbitrary budget caps. But at the same time, the members of Congress who are in charge of putting together the actual spending program for DOD are telling the department it can't actually cut anything. So the personnel example I used from the Air Force works this way. That they've been saying for months that if they've got to live under these caps, they absolutely have to become a smaller Air Force, reduce their end strength right away so they can afford to train and equip the people that they still have left behind. And they've gone through what they think is a pretty thoughtful process for making those reductions. And instead of just taking a lawnmower across the entire workforce and cutting every area equally, they're using what they call a surgical approach, cutting in areas, you know, where they don't think they will need so much in the future. The thing that's kind of guiding that workforce shaping is, of course, their own budget plan in the absence of further guidance from Congress, which calls for the elimination of some weapon systems, as you alluded to, like the A-10 Warthog. And then, of course, Congress steps in and says, sorry, we're not giving you any more money, but you have to keep the A-10 anyway. This is Lieutenant General Sam Cox, the Air Force's Deputy Chief for Manpower, kind of summarizing the Air Force's concern about that kind of thing.
The expectation is if we end up being forced to retain some kind of a force structure, that the manpower would come with it and the funding associated with it, because that's required. Otherwise, we end up with a broken force. And that's why we're sizing this to be, you know, whatever the size of the force is, we're going to be ready. And so you add those other things, and we're not balanced.
And so, again, taken as an individual matter, this one particular area is not going to break the defense budget. But again, I think it's illustrative of the dynamic that's going on right now, where the department has actually come to grips with reality and is trying to figure out ways to keep things running relatively smoothly under sequestration. And, you know, the Congress that approved sequestration hasn't quite reached that point yet.
So it seems like there's a disconnect, or I guess a repetition of the disconnect, which seems to happen every year. And that is this: the case for this particular plane can be made fairly strongly because it's already built, it's cheap, and it's well understood. There's no high cost with it. But it seems like in the planning of the NDAA, Congress and the Pentagon don't talk. They come up with their plans on parallel tracks. Why does that never change?
I don't know. Gosh, that's a great question, Tom, and I don't know that I have an answer for that. And just to add, you know, one more thing to the benefits of the A-10, in addition to the fact that it's already operating, it's extremely effective. And the Air Force, along with the Army, will be the first ones to admit that. But they say, look, you know, if we've got to take this amount of money out of the budget, we've got to reduce our force structure in ways that takes a lot of money all at once. And the rationale for things like taking entire inventories of weapon systems like the A-10 and the U-2 is that you don't get the kind of money that you need out of the budget just by reducing, you know, by cutting the A-10 fleet in half or cutting the U-2 fleet in half. You need to take the entire thing out so that you take out the entire logistics tail and the workforce tail that accompanies that. That's the only way you hit these kind of numbers. They really think they have to do those kinds of things, because the only other way to take a large amount of money out of the budget all at once results in things like what we saw last year when sequestration first hit. You know, the go-tos where you can get a lot of money suddenly are things like readiness and training, where you ground, you know, huge squadrons, many, many squadrons of aircraft. They're determined not to repeat that process if Congress will allow them.
And one could say perhaps that the Pentagon planners, that the military is in a way playing hardball with Congress, saying, well, if you want these projects and they're not the top priority, personnel is, you need to undo sequestration. But is that actually a conversation that any of these people who have a hand in this authorization bill are discussing?
it's really not, and it's that's a weird dynamic too, because the people that are in charge of drafting the DoD authorization bill are the people who precisely care the most about defense. And they would, I guarantee you, any of them would turn sequestration off in a heartbeat tomorrow. But they're not, you know, they are not the 435 members of the House. You know, there are other members of the House that are not that interested in turning off sequestration. So what you have is not necessarily suggestions for alternatives to sequestration, but in the past, you've seen a lot of finger pointing. And as I said before, just kind of a denial of reality that this is here. And the important thing about that is, while they have found some ways, they think, to make things work through 2015, even though DOD doesn't like it, as Adam Smith, the ranking member on the House Armed Services Committee, has pointed out repeatedly, they're creating a huge bow wave of problems in 2016 and beyond. Not only do the caps get lower, the DOD has to cut its budget even further, but the programs that it wants to remove from the budget right now create savings in those out years that are much bigger than they are in 2015. So it's just setting up this huge wave of problems in the future.
We're speaking with DOD reporter Jared Serbu. Now, you have a couple of bright points in today's column, and that is, it looks like on the mobility front, the DOD is finally learning how to get mobile devices approved for DOD use while the manufacturer is still actually making them.
How about that, huh? We've been covering this for years, haven't we, Tom? I mean, the last time DOD approved a non-BlackBerry device, it was no longer available for purchase. It was off the shelves. The security approval process took so long. It looks like they've finally started to crack the code on that. And all the legwork they've done in terms of creating process improvements in that area just looks like it's starting to pay off. So what they've just done is released a security technical implementation guide for the Samsung Galaxy S4. It needs to run a specialized version of the Android operating system called Samsung Knox. But the good thing about that is the manufacturer, Samsung, actually did a good amount of the legwork to actually put that STIG, as it's called, in place, based on the fact that DOD last year put together basically its requirements. It said, hey, industry, this is what we need in order for a device to be approved on our networks. In the past, what they've done is they've taken something off the shelves, and DOD itself has figured out, here are the thousands of different tweaks we need to make in order to force this device into our environment. They've kind of flipped that process around, and at least in this one individual case, it looks like it's working. So, you know, definitely some optimism there in terms of the future of commercial mobility in DOD.
And finally, Jared, you have some insight, which I think is really wise insight, into what happened at the Veterans Affairs Department on Friday, where Robert Petzl, who was leading the health benefits division, resigned in the wake of allegations of waiting lists gone awry and veterans dying because of it at health clinics. And yet he is a longtime veteran of VA. He was set to retire.
He was set to retire, and he is one of the three officials who the American Legion famously a couple weeks ago demanded to be fired by the president. This was the day after a hearing in which Eric Shinseki, the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, said that he would not resign and promised to uncover problems and get to the bottom of this. So Petzl's resignation was announced a day later in a manner in which made it very clear that the VA wanted to suggest that he was being fired. They did not mention that he was scheduled to retire at the beginning of this month. So Jeff Miller, the Republican chairman of the House Veterans Affairs Committee, was one of many people who pointed out that this is a bit disingenuous for VA not to even mention that. I'll just read his quote here. Characterizing this as a resignation doesn't pass the smell test. Desperate to get away ahead of a delay in healthcare crisis that's growing by the day, yet apparently unwilling to take substantive actions to hold any of its leaders accountable, VA's resorted to what it does best, splitting semantic hairs to create the illusion of accountability and progress. Again, Jeff Miller's words, not mine, but it was noteworthy, I thought, that VA made it try to appear that it was firing someone who was already supposed to have retired.
So that makes the situation probably worse. There's going to be more hearings on this, correct? And it looks like the scandal might be spreading day by day with greater and greater numbers that we're hearing about of people who took a long time to get into or maybe never made it into a VA hospital.
That's right, and not just in numbers, but in more geographic locations, which gives this at least the initial appearance of being a bit of a systemic problem across VA. And, you know, Jeff Miller, again, has subpoenaed VA for its records into this investigation. The VAIG has its has an examination going on in Phoenix right now. It says through that process, it's found evidence of more problems throughout the country. The VA Inspector General, Acting Inspector General, actually also suggested last week that there may be criminal violations here. He's asked for help from the U.S. Attorney in Arizona and also the Department of Justice's Public Integrity Section.
And Jared, having gone to the hearings and seen the faces and heard the tones of voice being used in those hearings, how long do you think Shinseki can hold out before the White House says, okay, that's enough?
That's pure
speculation, I understand.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'd prefer not to get into that business. But Shinseki himself has made it very clear that he has no intention of stepping down until the president himself says it's time to go. I mean, and it's worth pointing out that the American Legion is kind of a lonely voice here among the veterans community. The rest of the veteran services organizations, the large ones around the country, even though the American Legion is the biggest, the remainder of them seem to be saying, we're outraged about this problem and other problems, including the backlog in the Veterans Benefits Administration. Shinseki has made progress, and he's probably our best hope of continuing to make progress against these problems, and it's premature to ask him to step down.
Jared Serbu is Federal News Radio's DOD reporter. Congratulations on the inauguration of your new column, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.